وآل محمد.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The United States conflict with Russia, which some say is self-made, has taken different dimensions. With the focus to create instability in the Eurasia region, comprised of countries like Ukraine, possibly Kazakhstan being the latest victim. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the nature of the West's new rivalry with Russia, even though it is different from that of the Cold War during the Soviet era. Geopolitical and social developments in Eurasia are becoming more like the events and alliances of the 19th and of the early 20th centuries. We're just joining us to break this down for us and give us an insight. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author, joins us from London. Also joining us, Earl Rasmussen, Executive Vice President of the Eurasian Center, who joins us from Washington, D.C.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, I'd like to welcome you both, and I'm going to start first with you, Marcus Papadopoulos, if I may. Some may say, what is a color revolution, especially in Europe? If you can please explain to us what that means in the context, of course, of recent developments.
Let me first of all say that at the beginning of 1992, the West, intoxicated by its victory in the Cold War, following the end of communism in Eastern Europe, and then the disillusion of the Soviet Union, observed an opportunity to extend its political, economic, and military power by extending NATO and the European Union into Eastern Europe and also into the former Soviet space, the Baltic states. Because Washington and also London were aware that by capitalizing on the demise of Soviet communism and the demise of the USSR, that would mean the West's overall power in the world would be increased tremendously. So that is why NATO and the EU expanded into Eastern Europe. But Washington and London at that time underestimated the resolve of Russia. They underestimated the resolve of the Russian people. It never dawned on them that on numerous occasions in Russian history, Russian states had collapsed only to be changed into a new powerful Russian state. Mm-hmm. So Tsarist Russia gave way to the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union gave way to the Russian Federation, which today is a superpower. But of course, the West is not finished in Eastern Europe or in Central Asia, because it is desperately seeking the admission to NATO of Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia. And also, the West is attempting to challenge Russia in Central Asia by fomenting civil unrest there. So what we saw recently in Kazakhstan, in my opinion, was an attempt by the Americans and the British to strategically weaken Russia by stirring civil unrest there in the hope that the government in Kazakhstan would be replaced by an anti-Russian, pro-Western one. And ultimately, the Washington and London was hoping to create two exceedingly dangerous fronts for Russia, specifically Ukraine and Kazakhstan. Well, they failed abysmally in Kazakhstan as a result of the rapid and effective response of the Collective Security Treaty Organization. But alas, they succeeded in February of 2014 in Ukraine. And as each day goes by, as each month and each year goes by, Ukraine is integrating further and further in the West, and NATO is expanding its presence in NATO, in Ukraine, and also in the Black Sea region.
Well, since you brought up Kazakhstan, I wasn't going to talk about it as of yet, but let's move on to that then, Earl Rasmussen, and ask you what you think about the developments in Kazakhstan. First of all, we had the Russian President Vladimir Putin come out and said we need to stop color revolutions after Russia sent the troops to Kazakhstan, blaming foreign forces, actually, for orchestrating what happened there. But there's more to the story. First of all, do you agree with the fact that Kazakhstan was a victim of this color revolution that did take place?
There's a lot of questions to be answered. There's a lot of confusion. We don't know all the facts yet on Kazakhstan. It is interesting. There's thousands of NGOs that are present. I think NED, National Endowment for Democracy, which is basically this arm of the CIO, pumped in over $1 million recently. There's over 85 to 100 UK society type organizations present. So there's foreign presence and I think it's interesting that the gas was already pre-announced about essentially like a dot. I mean, I guess we, in the U.S., they have increased over the last year. But it's right around.
Yeah, I'm sorry to jump in, Earl Rasmussen.
And just before Christmas,
we're getting you in a broken up fashion. Unfortunately, we don't have a good connection with you. Let me move to you, Marcus Papadopoulos, to wrap up Kazakhstan, because I'd like to also talk about, again, Russia somewhat as a focus here. There's one source that has put, and you need to put this into context for us if you can, Marcus Papadopoulos, one source stating that there was a U.S., Turkish, British, Israeli-led coup attempt that was occurring in Kazakhstan, and there was actually a military intel operation room that had U.S., Turkey, Israeli operatives that were working out of that. If that's the case, are we looking at a concerted effort, as you started out the program, in terms of the way that the U.S. and NATO, and now we could perhaps bring Israel into the picture here, that this is what they're after. The U.S. and NATO, well, the U.S. steering this, and as you said, to destabilize these countries in Eastern Europe.
Ever since Kazakhstan and indeed the whole of Central Asia became independent at the end of 1991, the West, principally America and Britain, has attempted to stir trouble in the region in the hope of usurping Russia's position as the predominant outside force in the region. Indeed, we saw a so-called color revolution take place in Kyrgyzstan in 2005, which Russia was able to contain, and which as a result meant that Kyrgyzstan would remain in Russia's orbit. But certainly that there was, during the 1990s and the 2000s, a concerted effort by the Americans and the British to challenge Russian dominance in Central Asia. And in the 1990s, inroads were made by both of them. It should also be said that the Chinese also made inroads in Central Asia in the 1990s as a result of Russian impotence at the time, but still Russia maintained its supremacy in the region. And following Vladimir Putin's ascension to power in 2000, that dominance became all the more profound. But if the reports concerning Turkey, Turkish and Israeli involvement in the attempted coup in Kazakhstan are correct, then that will have a drastic impact on Russia's relations with both Turkey and Israel. But what is for certain is that America and Britain did attempt a coup in Kazakhstan. What we saw in Kazakhstan from the militants there was very similar to what we saw at the end of 2014 and early 2014 in Ukraine, namely very well organized, very well motivated, very well led militants who were competent in the use of firearms.
Indeed.
But the CSTO met the challenge. Remember, the CSTO was created to deter, to counter foreign encroachment on the territories of the six members, namely Russia, Belarus, Armenia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. So the CSTO met the challenge, and met the challenge emphatically well.
Very well. We have Earl Rasmussen with us, unfortunately just on the phone, but let's get his take on this. Earl Rasmussen, we're talking about what has happened in Kazakhstan, and you were speaking there. Unfortunately, we didn't hear all of your statements, but please expand more for us what you were saying. And you said there are more questions than answers. But again, there are lots of details that are coming out. First, if you can continue where you left off so we can at least get a gist of what you said before.
Sure. We've got thousands of non-governmental organizations, civil society organizations that are present in Kazakhstan. I think National Endowment for Democracy pumped in over $1 million recently. So there's a lot of questions. Also, the timing is very interesting. Right near the Orthodox holidays for Christmas, and just prior to the security discussions between the U.S. and Russia. So I think it's very interesting timing. We also have to look at Kazakhstan, its geographical position, over 7,000 kilometers along the southern border of Russia. But at the same time, it also has access to China and is a key component of the Belt and Road Initiative. So actually, you've got, if you can cause disruption in Kazakhstan, you're basically addressing two objectives of U.S. foreign policy.
Okay, I'm going to stick with you, if I may. Again, we're seeing these details come through as to what has happened in Kazakhstan. And one of the things that is definitely true, based on what the Kazakh president has said, is that there were militants that were in that country, and he mentioned Afghanistan. Now, what is very interesting about that is the fact that you have Daesh terrorists that are present in Afghanistan that have sifted through, along with terrorists from other countries, but Afghanistan in particular, that have sifted through, come through, and somehow made it to Kazakhstan. We know that the U.S. was there. We know that many of these terrorists were either covertly or indirectly being supported by the U.S., the ones that were transferred out of Syria, and Iraq, who made their way into Afghanistan. So are we looking at that being the way that the U.S. is actually, at least one of the methods, of destabilization of another country by using terrorists and bringing them in?
Absolutely. I think you saw that in Syria as well. The so-called moderate rebels. I don't know if they really were ever moderate rebels. But yes. Yes, I think you'll see alliances with whatever kind of groups that have closer alliances with jihadists and with extremists. And yes, they'll use that. I mean, will that backfire on them? Absolutely, at some point in time. But they are using, I believe that there's alliances with the intelligence communities with extremists that are then causing disruption and helping organize organizing demonstrations.
Okay. Well, Marcus Papadopoulos, you mentioned that these efforts have failed when it comes to Russia. Russia is trying to make sure that its sphere is not being broken into. Obviously, the way it's standing up next to NATO and steered by the U.S. in terms of the eastward expansion, which NATO keeps doing. And it has reached a point where the Deputy Foreign Minister of Russia in a press conference said this is not tolerable and said conflict may be inevitable of a nuclear nature, I believe is what he said. Do you think that this has reached that point, or are we looking at the abyss but then pulling back?
I am not one for exaggeration. I am not one for melodrama. But I will say this. The situation today in the world between America and Russia is exceedingly dangerous on account of American expansionism, of American aggression. Russian national security, make no mistake about it, is dangerously threatened in Eastern Europe. It is dangerously threatened by the West's presence in Ukraine, specifically NATO's presence in Ukraine. Even though Ukraine is not a member yet of the Western military bloc, NATO does have soldiery of its own there, and it has its weaponry in Ukraine. And the Americans and the British will continue to supply high-tech weaponry to Ukraine, which could pose a very serious threat to Russian national security. Mm-hmm. That is why Russia will use all means at its disposal to ensure that Ukraine never, ever joins NATO, because a Ukraine in NATO would pose a tremendous threat, a tremendous menace to Russia. The Russian strategic nuclear deterrent would be in jeopardy. Nuclear parity between America and Russia as a result would be disrupted. So Russia will go to war over Ukraine. Russia does not seek war. The Russian people do not seek war. Let us not forget that during the Second World War, what the Russians call the Great Patriotic War, nearly 30 million Soviet citizens died. But if need be, Russia will go to war with any country in the world to prevent Ukraine from joining NATO.
Okay, so if that's the case, that Russia would do that, and it seems like from any posturing that you take a look at, from Russia's defense minister to the Russian president to you name it, they're ready for that. The question is, the U.S. sounds that war drum, but it wants to do it through NATO, and at the same time, it says we represent Europe in a sense, even though it says we have to talk to our European partners. I'm guessing they're not. Everybody in Europe is on board. Is that a correct perspective on this, or vantage point on this? Earl Rasmussen, if you're with us, the question is for you.
I think there's division within Europe. I think you see already see the French and German foreign ministers going to Russia later this week, or within the next week. I think there's definite division. Europe has already lost almost 300 billion euro of trade with Russia over the last several years. And if more sanctions are put in place that are being threatened, it will have huge blowback on Europe and potentially the U.S. Economically, it'd be a disaster for the world. Perhaps Russia would survive better with their alliances with China. So it's a very dangerous situation, and I would agree on that. I think there's a division in Europe right now, and the U.S. is kind of dictating energy policy, economics policy, and security policy without really consulting Europeans.
All right. Well, the NATO chief, and I'm not asking you, Marcus Papadopoulos, to go toe the line of speculation towards the war scenario, but the NATO chief issued a warning in that press conference hours earlier of a new armed conflict in Europe. His words, as Russia has stated, the West needs to respond to our security concerns. Of course, NATO, according to Russia and the Russian deputy foreign minister, said NATO didn't even look at our proposal, even though Stoltenberg said in that conference, we're going to send it to the U.S. anyways for the U.S. to look it over. Are we looking, again, at the possibility of there being a conflict, and how would that break out? Again, I know it's speculation, but that's a scenario that they're painting.
Well, excuse me, Mr. Stoltenberg, but who exactly has caused armed conflicts in Europe? Let us not forget, in 1999, NATO, led by its de facto leader, America, bombed the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, which violated Article 1 of NATO's own founding treaty, which clearly stipulates that the military bloc will never use force to resolve a dispute. Who caused the war in the Donbass in the east of Ukraine by having engineered a coup in Kiev against a democratically elected government in February of 2014? The Americans, the British, and the Europeans. Russia is responding to what is happening on its doorstep. Russia cannot retreat any further. Russia cannot be silent on the matter. Russian national security is at risk, and any further increase in NATO's presence in the Baltic states, in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, in the Black Sea region will make that menace to Russian national security all the more profound.
All right. To round this off, Earl Rasmussen, so you have these tools, you meaning the U.S. and NATO, NATO perhaps being one of the tools in the toolbox that the U.S. uses when it comes to these color revolutions, which is our core focus in this spotlight. You have the military side coming through NATO. You have the militants that we know perhaps somehow are affiliated with the U.S. in one way or another. You have the National Endowment of Democracy, NGOs such as USAID. What has the U.S. exhausted those tools as to be unsuccessful, as we saw in this latest episode when it came to Kazakhstan?
There may be more tools. I think Kazakhstan didn't have the sanctions that were placed upon them. Of course, Russia is experiencing that. But sanctions, obviously, is a major, major part of the toolbox that's being used to basically launch economic war against the target country to cause disruption. So I don't think all the tools were used in Kazakhstan, but I think it's been diverted to some degree. At least my contacts in Kazakhstan say it's much, much more peaceful. They feel much better now than they did a week ago. I think we've secured for now Kazakhstan, which is good, and they're aware of it. I think they're aware of the dangers on that, and we'll see what policies come out of there to better secure themselves.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. I'm glad we had you. Earl Rasmussen, Executive Vice President of the Eurasian Center from Washington, D.C. Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you for your input. Enjoyed it. Historian, political analyst, and author from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kamit Tafwe, entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly, I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly, she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules related to prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about rules about prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me ask you this question at the beginning of this episode. What is the Islamic law about the leather imported from non-Muslim countries? We all know that there is an import and export, and no place is like self-sufficient in that regard, and there are lots of exports, you know, or materials which are imported into the country, and some of them come from the non-Muslim countries. So should one be really extra cautious about the leather imported from those countries?
The question regarding leather has always been a frequently asked question. A lot of people, a lot of Muslims living in the West and also living in Muslim countries are very much concerned, they are worried, and they wonder as to what they should do with regard to the leather found in their countries but imported from non-Muslim countries. Grand Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that if leather is imported from such countries, and it's one doubts whether it is the leather that comes from halal animal or an animal slaughtered according to Islamic law or not, and the doubt persists, of course it is that leather is considered to be that leather is not treated to be impure, and the rule that applies to the skin of a dead animal or to the skin of, for example, an animal whose meat is essentially forbidden does not apply to the skin or to the leather that is imported from a non-Muslim, because there is a slight probability, there is a chance that the leather might be that of an animal that might have been slaughtered by Muslims and might have been slaughtered according to Islamic law. But okay, that But we have to also understand that in this scenario, you cannot use that leather during prayers. You cannot pray with that leather. You know, the leather that comes from or is imported from non-Muslim country, it's not treated to be an impure, but still you cannot pray with it. As a measure of precaution, you cannot, you know, you cannot pray with that leather. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So you cannot pray with a coat, with a leather coat imported from a non-Muslim country, from Britain, from America, from China, from any other countries, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot wear. But if you happen to touch it with a wet hand, you cannot treat it as impure. You cannot. It's not necessary for you to wash your hand.
Mm-hmm.
That's the benefit of the doubt, you know.
I see.
You have to give the benefit of the doubt to yourself in that case.
I see. But we all know that they don't sacrifice, for example, those animals in the way that Muslims do.
You're right.
All right?
And that's
so that should make it ritually impure then.
Yeah, that is for sure. If you know for sure that this is the leather of an animal which has not been 100% sure,
mm-hmm,
that it has not been slaughtered according to Islamic law, that is najis. It's impure.
But they are coming from non-Muslim countries,
yeah,
we know.
That comes from. There are thousands of Muslims living in those countries, and there is a chance, a probability, though not very strong,
yes,
a probability that that leather might be from the leather of an animal which might have been slaughtered according to Islamic law.
I see.
So that's why if you touch it with a wet hand, you don't have to wash your hand. You do not treat it as impure.
Right.
But then you cannot wear it during prayer. It's a choice that you should make, you know, that, yeah, you cannot pray with that cloth. You have to take it off.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and our dear guest speaker here in the studio is still Sheikh Javid. We are talking about the rules about prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, you know, we know that a lot of people these days keep pets at home.
Yeah.
All right? And some of these pets are not necessarily like pure animals per se. All
yeah.
right? For example, they keep not only dogs, but they keep cats, for example,
cats
at home. We know that the shepherds, for example, they keep dogs because of guarding. We have the sheepdog, right?
Yes.
And it's something like a must for the shepherds,
yeah,
in fact, to guard against, to fend it off, for example, the wolves or any predators.
You're right.
About their, for example, animals they keep. But sometimes even people keep like an animal such as cats.
Mm.
So if they are playing with the cats at home, there is a chance that their clothes are somehow, have a little hair of the cat stay on it. All right. So in that case, would they be able to offer the prayers in that dress?
And there is a general principle, and this principle is accepted by a wide, range of scholars, except Grand Ayatollah Sistani. When it comes to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, he believes and he maintains that cat hair makes the prayer void.
Mm-hmm.
No matter there is one thread, one strand of cat hair,
yes,
or two or more, okay? If you find cat hair on your cloth, or if you find rabbit hair on your cloth, you should remove it. And if you know that there is cat hair, you cannot pray. You cannot pray with the cloth on which there is cut here. Okay?
But if you're not sure?
If you're not sure, if you happen to know after you have prayed that there was cut here on your cloth, you are, your prayer is valid because you did not know and you could not take any action when you did not, you are not supposed to take any action when you did not know that there was cut here on your cloth.
Yes.
So you're, if you know and you deliberately offer your prayer with the cut, with cut here on your cloth or on your body, your prayer is going to be invalid.
Mm-hmm. How about cat saliva?
Yeah.
If any small drop of the saliva of cat saliva drops on your clothes, would that be an invalidating agent?
You're right. Cat saliva is also, it's not najis. But, you know, according
it's not like the dog's saliva, basically.
Yeah, of course, it's not like that. But cat saliva, again, it makes your prayer white. If you know there is cat saliva and you pray with it, you cannot, you should pray, you should repeat your prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, according to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, you cannot, and there's a ruling, if you know, ruling 86, of course, you can, our audience, those who understand or speak Persian, they can refer to the manual of Islamic laws written by Grand Ayatollah Khamenei.
Yes.
Of course, he clearly states that cat saliva makes the prayer white. But if it dries up, and there's no saliva seen on your clothes or in your body, then you can pray with it because it's non-existent now.
I see.
Yes.
But what about the bird's excretion on the dress, you know? Especially a new suit, you know, when you're wearing a new suit to work, for example, it happens that, in fact, sometimes the birds may hover around and then they excrete something on it and then make it dirty. And sometimes the birds, in fact, are not ritually impure. For example, we are talking about like the excretion of a sparrow or a pigeon.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it might be the excretion of a crow or an eagle.
Yeah.
So in that scenario, does it make it like make the prayer invalid?
According to a general principle, all the animals that whose meat are forbidden to eat, like rabbits, like birds of any category. And like say jackals, foxes, and so on and so forth. The animals whose meat is haram to eat, their urine and their stool, their feces or their excretion are impure. So now if you compare a pigeon with a crow or a pigeon with an eagle, the urine or the excretion of a pigeon is not najis because its meat is halal. Okay. But the excretion of an eagle or a haram bird is najis, and if it let's say drops something on you, you cannot pray with it. Your prayer will be affected. If you know for sure that there is crop excretion on your body or on your clothes, you must remove it, otherwise your prayer will not be valid.
And it's not about the size either?
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't make any difference.
Like the blood you said?
Yes. It doesn't make Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwa is general. He doesn't say that, okay, if there is a lot or a big quantity of bird excretion, then you should remove it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Ever since the Great Recession began, decreased purchasing power has been the number one complaint of French voters. Because one in four Frenchmen suffers from a serious housing problem, Emmanuel Macron made better and more housing a central plank of his 2017 presidential campaign. Today, inflation just hit record highs in France and across the Eurozone, and housing has become even more expensive during the coronavirus crisis.
A recent poll showed that 3 out of 4 French people feels that their purchasing power has diminished, and 90% of the country is concerned about it. While the elite may be able to afford these higher costs, it's clear that the rest of France is deeply concerned.
Top NGOs and some unions gathered in Paris to warn all candidates that recent years have seen untold socioeconomic damage, which could result in more political upheavals.
And this is the reason why these organizations have come together, to be able to raise a cry of alarm and try and intervene in the campaign.
Affordable housing has long established fixes. Write laws which favor tenants and not landlords. Put more tax revenue into building new housing and create more shelters for those with emergency needs. The Macron era has implemented none of these solutions, which has allowed the price of real estate to cross the records of 10,000 euros per square meter in Paris and 3,000 euros nationwide. Inflated or not, real estate must be heated in winter, and record energy prices has the government already admitting they are worried about the social fallout which soaring prices could cause, as in 2018 with the Yellow Vests.
In the election, socioeconomic questions will be very prevalent because inequalities have gotten so much worse in recent years. Households are either having major problems paying their bills or simply getting evicted. The current government has made no initiatives to remedy these problems, especially regarding housing.
Some believe that housing is for living in, and some believe that housing is for investment speculation. But in a French election dominated by right-wingers, the leading candidates will be forced to at least pay lip service to the idea of state-sponsored remedies to soaring prices. Paris.
Families waiting outside the All India Institute of Medical Sciences. 400, sometimes more. This bus stop is the stopover, perhaps a waiting area. All they wait for is the appointment with doctors. Few I spoke with don't care about the new COVID outbreak, and many are even confused what it is and what it does. They say our loved ones are dying anyway, due to lack of treatments and medical assistance. Coronavirus cases driven by the new Omicron variant have skyrocketed in India, prompting the government to rapidly reinforce a series of restrictions. The administration of Prime Minister Modi says it is confident and fully geared up to handle any situation in the wake of new COVID outburst, largely driven by Omicron variant. Health experts, however, have urged the government to halt the ongoing election campaigns, which they say could spark another healthcare crisis in the country. On Tuesday, the country recorded 168,000 new infections, including 4,400 cases of Omicron variant. 227 deaths were also reported, based on official data. The overall COVID case tally has increased to around 35 million, while the death count rose close to 480,000. And overall recoveries stand at 34.5 million.
We take things slightly, as usual, and we saw the result in April. Many people think this Omicron is nothing new, but we need to be cautious.
Despite alarming rise in fresh COVID cases, the political parties are busy with election rallies ahead of crucial state polls in five key Indian states of Uttar Pradesh, Punjab, Uttarakhand, Goa and Manipur, which begins February 10. Rallies packed with thousands of people, many without masks, is making health experts worried.
We have learned from first and second wave, and even if we see the private and the public sectors in health sector basically in India, so everyone have leveled up their care practices and they are also providing the specialized care for the COVID.
Over the last 2 weeks, hospital admissions are rising and medical staff has been advised to cut their leaves. New Delhi, Maharashtra, Rajasthan and parts of southern India are reporting maximum cases, including the new variant. Earlier waves of the pandemic unfolded mayhem in the subcontinent. Healthcare collapsed. People begged for oxygen and hospital beds, graveyards and crematoriums ran out of space. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The pandemic appears to be spiraling out of control in the United States, pushing the country into uncharted territory. Many states are witnessing a dramatic surge in infections. Just in a single day, two new records have been set, sounding the alarm about the severity of the situation. Authorities are now reporting more than 1.3 million additional cases. That's the highest daily total of any nation in the world. The previous record set last week was just a little above 1 million. The 7-day average has also been soaring in recent weeks. It's now over 700,000 cases a day, three times higher than 2 weeks ago. Deaths have also increased, averaging around 1,700 per day. That's 20% up from 1,400 posted in recent days. Omicron is largely to blame for the rise. The extremely contagious variant is spreading like wildfire in many parts of the world, and the US is no exception. It's the world's worst-hit nation by far, with around 62 million cases and over 800,000 deaths. Vaccine maker Pfizer says a redesigned vaccine is likely needed to specifically target Omicron. US medical centers are already overwhelmed and the Omicron wave is now pushing them to the brink. The number of daily hospitalizations has hit a new peak. Over 140,000 more patients are being treated in hospitals whose staff have already been worn out by the Delta variant. Experts are of the opinion that many Americans' refusal to get their shots is probably one key factor stoking the spike. About 37% of the population has not been fully vaccinated. Some cities like Chicago and New York are imposing restrictions and vaccination rules to curb the trend, the kind of measures that are likely to once more bring anti-vaxxers onto the streets. Whatever the causes may be, the facts speak for themselves. The battle against the coronavirus is a tough one, and the US, already the number one in many global categories, has now one more to add to its records, the world's number one in its failure against the virus.
As Afghans are struggling with a rising hunger combined with harsh winter, the Iranian embassy in Kabul, in cooperation with Imam Khomeini Relief Foundation, distributes rounds of aid and food to vulnerable people across Afghanistan.
Iran's humanitarian aid to the Afghan people is continuing in different provinces of Afghanistan. In the capital Kabul, we aim to provide vulnerable families with food and warm clothes. Today, these batches of relief assistance, including flour, oil, and rice, are going to be distributed among Afghan teachers and unemployed people.
Unemployment, cash shortage, and the rise in prices have switched many to poverty and hunger. Nowadays, as winter sets in, millions of Afghans are awaiting relief assistance.
We're
absolutely in need of such aid. I have a family of 10. We thank Iranian people for helping us in this dire situation. Their aid can help us survive one more month. We also demand Islamic countries and the international community to support us in this harsh winter, as we are short of food and warm shelter.
I'm a teacher and have 8 children. My husband is jobless. I have been unpaid for 4 months. Nowadays, we really don't have anything to eat or heat our houses. Other teachers have the same difficult situation. What should we do if we don't rely on foreign aid? I hope such aid continues for all throughout this winter.
Iran has delivered 14 rounds of aid to the people of Afghanistan since the Taliban took over and the financial crisis in August. This comes as nearly $10 billion in Afghan assets remain frozen by the U.S. and a large number of funds to the country are halted. Harsh winter in Afghanistan is worsening the dire situation, adding to the number of people in need. Most families are relying on such assistance because it is a matter of survival for them. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On January 9th last year, the Hassan family of Somali origin living in Cardiff, Wales, were stricken by grief. Their son, 24-year-old Mohammed Hassan, found dead in his own apartment.
Around 10:30 at night, Mohammed was discovered by a friend when he tried to wake him up to go to the hospital, and they realized he was dead.
Hassan, who was only months away from being a father, was arrested on January 8th on suspicion of a breach of the peace, moved here and detained overnight.
It soon emerged that while he was here, Mahmoud came into contact with over 50 members of Cardiff Police. The next morning, he was released without a charge. When he went home, his family say he was battered and bruised and his clothing splattered in blood. He went to bed later that same day, never to wake up again.
That raised red flags for his family, who then demanded to see police body cam footage of his detention. 1 year on, they're still waiting.
By the look of it, we're not going to be able to see the footage. But if we were allowed to see the footage, if we were allowed to see the last hours of Mahmoud's life, then we would be able to, regardless of what we saw, we would be able to move on. We would be able to grieve, but we would have a closure.
An investigation launched last year by the IOPC, the police watchdog in charge of the probe, is still ongoing. So far, it served misconduct notices to 6 officers and questioned more than 40 others. Hassan's family have criticized attempts to blame him for his own death, a reference to the coroner's report last year that Hassan had been drinking and taking drugs and gotten into a fight on the night of his arrest.
If you're from a black or African, Caribbean or Asian descent in this country, you know that deaths in custody are often followed by attempts to besmirch the reputation of the victim or the victim's family. No difference in this case. But can we just say absolutely for the record that the toxicology reports do not support that assertion?
Those supporting the Hassan family in their quest for the truth say his death is yet another incident in which a black person has died after contact with British police. For Hassan's family, closure on his unexplained death is yet to come. Saeed Puriza, Cardiff, Wales.
The severe shortage of fuel in Yemen is deteriorating the healthcare system in the country. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the rate of infant deaths has increased amid the severe fuel crisis caused by the continued detention of oil ships by Saudi Arabia.
There is a high rate of infant deaths we face in our department, especially for children with congenital defects or respiratory infections. These children need intensive care and incubators, but unfortunately, the fuel crisis has caused the suspension of many important medical devices to save their lives.
Health officials here say many intensive care units and emergency rooms had to stop providing services due to the lack of fuel, which has led to the death of more patients, including children. They want the United Nations to intervene and force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it has imposed on Yemen.
The fuel crisis has caused us many problems, especially with children who need blood transfusions and those with cancerous diseases. We need medical solutions urgently, but the fuel crisis is causing delays, and this makes saving the lives of children difficult. We urge international organizations, especially the United Nations, to do their duty and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. It has prevented the entry of oil vessels and seized them. This has led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage.
Severe fuel crisis has significantly worsened the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where most people have no access to basic health services. And the chaos caused by the Saudi blockade, Yemeni children have suffered the most. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinians protested in front of the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. The rally was held to highlight the plight of Palestinian prisoners who suffer from medical negligence by their Israeli captors. The event comes as Palestinian prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, a cancer patient held in Israeli jails, suffers a serious deterioration in his health condition. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Abu Hamid was still in a coma and fighting for his life. During a press conference, White Society for Prisoners said the Israeli regime will be forced to release Palestinian prisoners.
The Palestinian resistance will not leave the prisoners alone and will do all it can to secure their release. Resistance factions have secured the release of over 1,000 prisoners since 2011 and will force the Israeli regime to free more prisoners. Our enemy only understands the language of force. The Palestinian resistance will alleviate the suffering of Palestinian prisoners.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Palestinian prisoners are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits.
I have been suffering for more than 30 years while waiting for my son to be free. When he was arrested, I was 40 years old, and now I am over 70. I pray to God to keep me alive so that one day I can hold my son in my arms. Every night I cry myself to sleep worrying about my son.
Latest statistics show that Israel has imprisoned over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors.
We are extremely worried about our sons and daughters inside Israeli jails. My son has been in jail for 7 years and I was able to visit him only twice. The situation inside Israeli prisons is extremely difficult and all Palestinian prisoners are suffering, especially due to medical negligence and the inhumane treatment.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes. People here are demanding international protection for Palestinian prisoners who continue to suffer inside Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A new hiking trail and birdwatching facility opened up in South Korea this past November. DMZ Crane Peace Town created special birding cabins and guides wilderness hikes north of the 38th parallel, near the DMZ, the fortified border with North Korea. The demilitarized zone was created with the armistice that ended the Korean War back in 1953. Guard post fencing and a 2 to 4 kilometer wide buffer zone now separate North Korea and South Korea, with that no man's land becoming home to rejuvenated plant and wildlife. Local officials see wildlife tourism as an opportunity to promote inter-Korean peace.
Cranes know no borders. That's why we're promoting the crane as a symbol of peace, as they can freely come and go between North and South Korea.
Each winter, several species of birds, especially cranes, spend time to rest and feed in the area, where there's little development and few people. Officials say more birds have been coming here because of depleted feeding grounds in the north.
Sichuan has wide plains suitable for growing rice. Cranes eat the grain that has fallen after harvest, and it's the best place for cranes because it's located north of the civilian control line.
A safe vantage point to photograph the wildlife is provided at the Hantan River near Yangji Village, attracting birders from far afield.
I left home at 4 in the morning to come here to photograph wild birds, swans and cranes. It's good because there are many mallard